Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Countercurrents Radio Live. My name is Pox Populi. I'll be sitting in as the host again, sort of, tonight. And we do have two guests with us, David Zutty and Greg Johnson. Right, so let's get started with tonight's theme of conversation. We brought David on specifically to talk about the Homeland Institute, which is a very exciting development in dissident nationalist politics and meta politics. So, David, I will hand it over to you. Tell us a little bit about this new venture.
Yes, so the Homeland Institute is a nonprofit, and it was created to explore the negative effects of multiculturalism and diversity, which the mainstream narrative is that these are objective goods. There can be never too much of these two things, despite how even small amounts of them oftentimes have very negative effects. So we're exploring basically the reality of these negative effects, but also how we can have pragmatic and humane solutions to them. And we're doing a lot of stuff to do that. For example, we have articles. We're going to also eventually be proposing model legislation to make it very clear that we do not support individual candidates. We do not support specific bills. However, this would just be an academic thing. However, one of the very unique things that we're doing is that we're also conducting polls. We really wanted to get out of the, you know, this kind of feels like a rut of this ceaseless content creation. Content is important. It's important that we keep producing the message, keep it relevant, keep people entertained, and more importantly, informed and fired up. But I wanted to do something a little bit different than that, because it just feels like that's oversaturated. So my philosophy is that we're not really dissidents anymore. That's ridiculous. We have simply been pushed out of public life, but we are the majority. We will become the majority. And if we're not given a seat at the table, we're going to flip that table over. And part of this is that we're going to start acting like we're professional, like we're respectable. And part of that is polling. And this is important because there are both left-wing and right-wing and supposedly neutral think tanks that spend a lot of time and money and effort on polling. It's a big deal. In fact, I mentioned in our latest report on our latest poll about J.D. Vance's campaign, they were polling this one single district constantly every few weeks, all these different pollsters. So this is important. This isn't, you know, an abstract academic exercise. And we also want to break out these false narratives that are spun. And frankly, I don't trust mainstream polls anymore. They hide their data. I think they're biased. And too, I think the way they ask questions, they're trying to fish for a specific response, where you just want to find the truth. And we also want to tell people the truth because a lot of people are gaslit. For example, they've been told by all these little worm tongue like creatures that being accused of racism is like a death sentence. It's over. It's so horrible. It's the worst thing you could ever say. White people and colored people alike will just clutch their pearls about it. Maybe that's not true. Maybe this is all fake. We're just living in this fake narrative. We're going to try to like bust out of that and show people the truth.
I think that sounds absolutely fantastic. And I totally agree with trying something, creating something that isn't just commentary, and on the daily travesties of life in clown world. I think you're right to say that it's a bit saturated. And I am part of that saturation. Last week, I believe it was, in the wake of that sort of country song by Oliver Anthony that went viral, I even included myself. I said that our movement needs fewer Pox Populi, to be honest. It needs fewer people who just, you know, make commentary and Telegram posts and podcasts and YouTube videos. We need artists. We need singers. We need filmmakers, novelists. And we also need these sort of professional endeavors like the Homeland Institute. Greg, what are your thoughts on the matter?
Well, a lot of what creating content is not really that creative when you get right down to it, because it's just reacting to things in the news. The powers that be create a crisis and we react to it. The powers that be launch a poll, release the results, and we comment on it. And so one of the things that I wanted to do with the Homeland Institute was actually do our own research. Get new data and try and inject that into the national conversation. Because I've been very encouraged over the past few years, really beginning in late 2018. It was right after I published the White Nationalist Manifesto. I read Roger Eatwell and Matthew Goodwin's book, National Populism, The Revolt Against Liberal Democracy. And I was quite impressed with the studies that they had marshaled, the science studies have shown. And the studies were showing that national populism was not just some freakish occurrence that would go away very soon. It was actually being driven by long-standing and very, very stable trends that aren't going away. Trends like globalization, trends like the destruction of historic communities and homelands by multiculturalism and immigration. As long as those trends continue, we're going to see national populism as a result. I found that very encouraging. And so I started reading all this academic literature that was coming out. And there's quite a lot of literature like this. A lot of it's apologetic, a lot of it's pearl clutching, a lot of it's an attempt to wish us away, box us in, et cetera. But Eatwell and Goodwin really argued, no, this phenomenon is here to stay because of trends that they can show with science. I love that. Ashley Giardina in 2019 published a book called White Identity Politics, which had a lot of very compelling information about white identity and how very large numbers of white Americans have a positive racial identity. They think that whites are discriminated against by the current system, which is a rejection of the white privilege narrative. They also believe that it is completely permissible for whites to collectivize and fight for their interests in the political realm. In short, white identity politics. And yet the GOP will not service those preferences except with quote-unquote dog whistles, right? But they actually maintain a complete and total ban against white identity politics and only white identity politics. They're all for identity politics for other groups, but not white identity politics. And yet there's a real and I would say increasingly large constituency for white identity politics. And I wanted to measure that. Things like that really interested me. And so at a certain point, it occurred to me, instead of wishing for other people to do the polls that I would like to see, I could actually do this. And I used to say, wouldn't it be nice if we had a sort of a nationalist sort of policy institute? And that was really more me just making a dig at the failure of NPI, right? NPI wasn't doing any national policy stuff. But yeah. At a certain point, I realized, you know, I really shouldn't just be complaining that other people aren't doing this kind of work when I might be able to get an organization up and running to do it. And so at the end of 2021, I started thinking about creating the Homeland Institute. And I put together a team, I hired a consultant, and we basically spent a year creating the underlying corporation, then having it approved as a 501c3 by the IRS. And it took about exactly 1 year from start to finish of that process. And so it was basically a thing in late October of last year. The trouble was is that we raised some seed money. There were people who really wanted to help, but we spent a lot of the seed money just on the process of getting things going. And at the end of the process, we had a very limited budget. And so it took a while. And I was hoping, of course, that I'd get big donations, right? So we could start everything off in style. But realistically, that's very hard, especially because at the end of last year, we were going into a recession and we're still in it. And it's really bad. It's been very, very bad for nonprofits. Their fundraising is down 60% this year. This is not just true of Countercurrents, but many other nonprofits and not just political nonprofits. I am somewhat familiar though with creating an organization on an absolute shoestring budget because that's what I did with Countercurrents. And so I thought, okay, we'll just do it slow and steady. We'll let this grow as money comes in. We had donors sending us money. So when we had the money, we created the website. When we had the money, we greenlit the first poll. David is working for free, at least for starters. That was a huge thing for us to find somebody who's highly qualified and committed, who's willing to put in the sweat equity to get this thing up and running, because I run another institution entirely, and it's just not possible to really juggle running two institutions on a day-to-day basis, not well, at least. And so I found him to fill in that slot, and it's been hugely helpful. And so it finally moved forward. We got the first poll done. He wrote up the report. We published it last week, and we're waiting for reactions to it. Basically, we're trying to get it out there, get it in public discussion. And we're already working on the next poll. We have questions that we are refining. We are workshopping this around with movement people whom we respect to see if they have particular angles on this. And we're just going to keep polling until we run out of money for polls. And then we'll raise more money for polls. And eventually, if Homeland Institute grows to the point where we can pay our executive director, pay fellows, publish books, we will be doing other kinds of original research besides polling. But polling is hugely important. It's also something that can become quite newsworthy. In the last couple of years, the SPLC did a poll that got a lot of publicity about the penetration of the idea of the Great Replacement into the public. And of course, they wanted to publicize that because that's how they raise money. They raise panics, and they try and support censorship mm-hmm. and things like that mm-hmm. by showing that these terrible ideas are spreading. We want to show that these ideas have spread even more since that last poll. So, and we hope that we'll get both the left and the right commenting on this, because some of the results are really interesting. And the first poll is out now, and maybe David can talk about some of the consequences, some of the findings, which I think are pretty interesting.
Yeah, so I'll start with the first poll. There's really three major findings that I want to go over with this. So we did conduct this poll, and we were hoping that maybe being accused of woke was worse amongst white voters than being accused of racist. In hindsight, that was a little, you know, pie in the sky, but we still got very interesting results. For example, we found that about seven, if we take the number of people who said that they would actually follow through with a boycott against a business that's accused of racism, we found that about 7/10 of that number said that they would follow through with a boycott against a business that's accused of being woke. And this is important because we first asked a question like, would it make you less likely to support them? And the numbers were pretty bad. But here's the thing. There's a huge difference between Instagram activism, where you virtue signal and you press a little button, everyone, you know, you do basically nothing, but everyone just like says you're nice because you're basically virtue signaling away on your silly device and actually doing something. So we asked, were they willing to pay 10% more or drive an extra mile to actually do this boycott for both the accusation of racism and the accusation of being woke? They need to actually put their money where their mouth is, or else I don't take them seriously. And we found that about the power of the charge of woke was about 7/10 of the charge of racism. And those numbers, that might, you might say, well, that's 30% less. That's only 30% less. Remember that the charge of racism is something that everyone's supposed to like cower in fear of. This is a loaded gun that they've had pointed at everybody's head. And it's like a 9mm. Well, this is a 22. It's not as strong as a 9mm, but still, it's still something you should take very, very seriously. And it's also kind of like nuclear weapons. We may not be able to prevent the left from having a cancel culture. We may not be able to really diminish their power that much, but we can definitely get nukes of our own and create our own cancel culture. And, you know, we pretty sure that we saw this recently with both Target and the Bud Light drama. If you want the specific numbers, they said that 41.8% said we wanted to follow through with the actual boycott for the accusation of racism, while 29.1% said they'd follow through with the boycotting business over an accusation of woke. And here's the big thing, is that a lot of businesses have very, very slim profit margins. So this could destroy them. And, you know, firing somebody because they did a racism can, you know, that could be construed as woke. So that could push back against doxing and cancel culture, which has completely chilled public participation in America. And the other big thing I want to go over is in regards to votes. So we all know that the GOP is constantly pandering to minorities, whether it's Trump's platinum plan or recently Charlie Kirk. He basically said it's great to be white and whiteness is great. Then the next day says blacks could sway the election. And I'll go over why it's silly in a few seconds, but I'm sticking with our poll. We found that Republican voters were almost twice as likely to say they were less likely to vote for a candidate that's accused of being woke versus accused of racism. So Republican candidates, they're always, you know, beating around the bush because they're worried. It might be because of donor class. There's other reasons. But when they overcorrect like this, where they start pandering to the left instead of just being neutral about it, they come across as woke. And even if no, and if people perceive them as woke or they get accused of woke, they could be destroyed. And I think that did happen with the red puddle of 2022. A lot of people, they just didn't, they got turned off and it showed up. Were those people all our guys as claimed by some people? Probably not, but there were people who were influenced by our ideas or are sympathetic or kind of like on the red pill journey and they're purple pilled. You know, everyone's red pill, a lot of people's red pill journeys takes a long time and there's lots of bends and all that. So, you know, you usually don't go from normie to full racial consciousness overnight. These people, I think it's very encouraging. These are people who think like us, even if they aren't fully us. So we can use this to bully candidates. Republican candidates need to be very terrified of this accusation of woke. Almost the exact number was 42.6% for racism and 79% for woke. So we have a club in our hand and we need to start using that, I think. But then the one thing which I think is going to very much trigger the left, trigger everybody, the SPLC will be crying to their Chardonnay, is that 7.2% of white Republicans said that an accusation of racism made them more likely to vote for a political candidate. These are people who, this is important because you can only vote once, but these are people who, if they are passionate like I am, they usually bully other people into voting. They're like, you better go vote. I don't want to hear your excuses. People died for your right to vote. And so it's people like that who, through their personal connections, get out the vote, or they're more importantly, volunteers. I'm going to explore who exactly volunteers on political campaigns and their aspects in a separate poll probably. Because each campaign volunteer, they're only one person, they only vote once, but they can garner hundreds of other votes. So these people are worth more than just their single vote. You need to take these passionate people very seriously. And my speculation is that they're probably highly radical. So, you know, everyone thinks about just two classes, the donor class and the voting class. What about the volunteering class? That's something that's completely unexplored as far as I know, and I'm going to set out to explore it if I have the time and the money, which your generous contributions can help make possible. But yes, and I think I did find evidence of this. I'm not simply making this up or getting high off my own supply. Blake Masters was accused of doing a horrible racism because he simply mentioned that a lot of gun violence is committed by blacks. If you go to Vita or Ameren, that's very obvious. This isn't a conspiracy theory. And what happened was that there was a poll of his campaign, of the campaign versus the main Democrat frontrunner, and he was, that point, that lead actually shrunk after the drama started when the Daily Beast reported on it. So if anything, that drama got him votes. And after that, the voting, they just went all over the place. It was up and down, but there was finally a vote that showed Blake Masters a little bit ahead. It got very, very down to the wire. He ultimately lost those by a lot less than when he started out before that Daily Beast article, was like by 5%. So
there was one finding in this that David, just to cut in, there's one finding in the poll that really speaks to this, which is that in the poll, we asked people if they would be less likely to vote for a candidate accused of racism, or if it wouldn't make a difference, or if they'd be more likely to vote for a candidate accused of racism. And of the Republicans polled, we broke the Republicans out, 7.2% of Republican respondents said they'd be more likely to vote for somebody accused of this. Now, maybe that's just solidarity against people being accused of some overused fake sin, or maybe they actually are strongly in favor of people who stand up for their own group. Because one of the things that the poll is sort of presuming is that being accused of racism is something that happens to white people. And being accused of racism is what woke people do. Now, there's certain, you know, conservative civic nationalist types who love to talk about racism against whites. And so that sort of is something that we need to isolate with questions in future polls. I would love to know what percentage of these people think that way. But it is the case that there were people saying, I would vote for a Republican more if this charge were leveled against him. And one of the things that we didn't talk about was whether these charges are true. It was, we just talked about charges of racism, charges of wokeness, because that's really the level at which these things usually stay. Nobody actually goes through a careful process of shifting and sorting evidence to see if a person really is racist or woke. And politics is all about opinion. It's on the level of opinion, not truth. And I think David mentioned to me during the whole process of the poll that only one person wrote back and said, well, I would need to know if this is true or not. So I thought that was very interesting. But the actual process of questioning people about opinion is very, very tricky, because you can't get overly precise. You can't get really autistic about it. And when you're measuring opinion, you're not measuring truth. And that's an important thing to bear in mind. But 7.2% of Republicans claim they would support a candidate more if he's accused of racism.
I want to chime in and just correct that it's white Republicans.
White Republicans, yeah.
However, that's still a lot, because we make up 70% of the voter base for the entire electorate, both parties. So we're not to be sneezed at.
Yeah, and this was a poll specifically of white Americans. We were just talking to white Americans in this poll to see what white American attitudes were on this.
Another utility I find in these sort of polls is that, being that we already live in the metaverse, often what I see is reality concocted, conjured up into existence by media narratives. We've all seen this. We all understand how this plays out, at least those of us who've been in this and been paying attention to these things for some time. But this can manifest itself in the sort of addiction that the so-called bug man of today has to data and polls. And not just the bug man of today, but other policy institutes, political parties, activist groups. We saw this especially during the years of COVID, and how just everyone had data at their fingertips, and data was used to define policy, legitimize a certain restriction, or to undermine it, to criticize it. And so what I observed was that just everyone seems to have their own narrative, and then they use these data points or these facts or these polls to they basically shoehorn it into the narrative to justify or to legitimize it. And so what I find useful about these things is that through this kind of polling, we can create meta reality that becomes actual reality. We can whip out polls and data and say, look, this is what a certain percentage of the population wants. This is what they respond positively to. Our ideas are increasing in popularity, and it's a way of creating a narrative, whether or not, like you were saying there with the respondent who said, I need to know if these accusations are true. I'm convinced that the truth really doesn't matter, especially when it comes to democracy and politics. It's all perception. It's all narrative. It's all mythos. And so if you can have at your fingertips data, which gives this perception of, you know, reality, like, oh my gosh, there's a poll, there's data that's being used to back up these claims. And people like the Untermensch on Twitter, or I suppose X now, they will be sort of painted into a corner with this. They'll be taken aback. They'll be put on the back foot because they live in this world where, you know, I'm so clever, I'm so smart, and I get all my information is backed up by, you know, peer-reviewed studies and things like
that. You have a study for that.
Exactly.
One of my favorite memes is the Vouch meme where the guy says, your girlfriend is an abomination. And his response is, do you have a study for that?
I think this is exactly it. So now, if I were to say dissident, nationalist, pro-white ideas are popular, they are desired, and some, you know, libtard challenges and says, you know, no, they're not, you know, look at the Zoomers, they're the most LGBT generation ever. Look at, you know, such and such. Well, now I can actually whip out a poll and say, actually, here's some data. Here's a source. Here's a study on that. And it's showing that exactly what I say is true, that these ideas are popular and gaining ground.
You know, one of the things that the Groypers show is that there's a huge overlap between the LGBT and the far right. So
it's the strangest generation, isn't it?
It's like it's the strangest generation.
At the same time, it's incredibly paused and desperate, and it's just, you know, I really feel bad for some of the things that the Zoomers are born into and growing up with. And at least, you know, those of us, like, I'm a millennial, but we were kind of like the last generation, you know, to still have sort of a normal life before things went completely, you know, into the metaverse and hyper reality and social media constantly stealing our attention and changing our ways of thinking and behavior. The Zoomers really never had that chance. And yet, for all of the sort of pause and weirdness that the Zoomers are embracing, there is this other side, which is incredibly based. In fact, talking about polls, I was going to mention this later, but I suppose I'll bring it up now. There was an interesting poll that just came out of Europe recently. And Zoomers were included in the poll because it was a poll of 18 to 34-year-olds. And the question was if they would currently intend to vote for a far-right party in their next national elections. And some of the results are astonishing. I mean, not really astonishing, I suppose. But, like, for example, there was... one of the results in Belgium and Netherlands showed a negative discrepancy between men and women, in which more women are likely to vote for a far-right party than the men. In the Netherlands, it's by a margin of 1%, and in Belgium, it's by a margin of 2%. The women are more likely than the men to vote for a far-right party. And the percentages are all around, you know, 20, 25 to 30, to 35% of those respondents who would say they would definitely vote for a far-right party. And this included, you know, 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds. So again, interesting things to see with regards to the younger generation.
Yeah, I would just add in that a lot of this comes, you know, the left basically bombarded them with nihilism. And the millennials, you know, had their hand in that because I am an older millennial, and I despise other millennials because they saw the world how it should be, or at least, you know, it's still consumerist. There are a lot of issues, but they had like a semblance of normalcy. But I think this were brutally buck broken by the market crash of 2008. That's when all the weird, they all went really crazy all of a sudden. And, you know, they got very sanctimonious. They got like very weak. A lot of the men, people that I knew who were relatively normal before, and their liberals got very effeminate and hysterical. Trump came along, they're basically, you know, clutching their pearls nonstop, and it's just like very embarrassing. Like, dude, you're a man, just calm down. But, you know, they want to have this all this stuff put on pedestals, all this holiness, diversity can't be questioned. Well, you basically have overdosed the Zoomers on nihilism. Why should they take anything seriously? Like, our democracy, the capital, blah, 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 transgender rights. Like, it's basically a joke. Everything's a joke. And it comes through, like, how goofy Fortnite is. They have a Nicki Minaj skin in Call of Duty. And at some point, this is, you know, it's like, who cares? Like, yeah. Everything is goofy and silly and irreverent, and that's good. Like nobody, it's kind of, you know, Cthulhu, you summon forth Cthulhu, you get devoured. You should not summon forth what you cannot first put down, and they have unleashed these forces. They can't be stopped. All these, you know, very angry millennials, especially the female ones, act like school teachers or, you know, nuns, basically scolding people over racism. And Zoomers don't care because, first of all, they have to deal with the consequences, which I'm going to explore that. Probably basically, does all this correlate to direct experience with other races? But two, nobody cares. This is, there is no sacred cow diversity. Nothing is sacred.
Yeah, everything's been deconstructed. Everything that our forebears, you know, as recent as grandparents and great-grandparents, but of course going farther back, everything that they cherished has been subjected to iconoclasm and deconstruction and mockery. Except, of course, as many of us have noted, the Holocaust, that is still untouchable. But we're seeing that a lot of the younger people don't seem to care very much about this thing called the Holocaust. Why are we still caring about it? And of course, you know, Nick Fuentes has had a role in that, in shaping that mode of thinking. But others have as well. And I think just the overall zeitgeist of sort of perpetual irony of the Zoomers has caused them to just not really care very much about the Steven Spielberg version of history. And it's interesting watching the establishment wring their hands over that, but it's like, you brought this on yourself. You deconstructed everything. You took a chisel, you took a pickaxe at things that are sacred, and you completely, you know, wore them down. Well, what do you expect now? That there's this one thing that we're all not supposed to mock or question or laugh about? Well, no, it's not going to work like that. You've opened this sort of Pandora's box of irony and nihilism, as you put it. And now it's affecting this generation, which needs to be bludgeoned even more with the Holocaust narrative because they're not caring about it. And of course, this is also influenced by the increasing time distance, is that this is farther and farther ago. Why should someone born in 2010 care much about what happened in the 1930s? They're not going to.
Mm-hmm. I know it's ridiculous. And I was actually trying to slog through Leo Strauss's book, The Rebirth of Classical Political Rationalism. Greg can probably like fill in better on this, but one of the things that he saw, and one of the takeaways from this very dense book about philosophy — I'm more of a politics guy or esotericism than this high-level philosophy — but that the positivists, they always want — it's this weird thing where they want to have like no values, no morals, everything is equally true. But then they don't go all the way. They don't want to get on that roller coaster and go to the very end of it. They always jump off before they get to the top and they go down to the inevitable conclusion. The people who deconstruct have some very, very sacred values, and they're very, very touchy when you attack them. Like, why not just deconstruct themselves? They're stupid. And going back to the Holocaust thing, I know this is very silly, but in Fortnite, they had like a Martin Luther King Boulevard speech thingy, but also like a Holocaust memorial in Fortnite. This is how, not a World War II memorial, because, you know, the people who busted them out of the camps that they won't shut up about, those people don't deserve any credit, or the people in the factories who gave the wonderful Soviet Union, which is a paradise of freedom and human rights, tons of weaponry to destroy Europe. They're not mentioned into this, but they had to ban emoting in the Holocaust Museum, the digital one, because they knew that the Zoomers would not be reverent.
That's interesting.
That has to be just an example of, you know, the desperation of, you know, the ADL and all the other adjacent organizations and groups, you know, realizing that they're losing their grip. And what are we going to do about the Zoomers? So they like sat down and, well, they seem to like this thing called Fortnite. Let's see what we can do with Fortnite. And it just completely backfired.
One thing that concerns me, though, about nihilism and about irony, and they are connected, is that you really can't create anything based on irony or based on nihilism. It is an acid that destroys, but I don't think anything can be created with it. And this is why I still fear for the future. I think it's very interesting that the sacred cows of the establishment are being criticized, rejected, overthrown. The trouble with irony, though, is that it's ultimately non-committal. It's one foot in, one foot out. And I don't think you can be ironic and heroic at the same time. Mm-hmm. Irony is not being committed. And political intensity, political heroism, they require commitment, taking things seriously. You got to get past it's all just a joke. You're going to actually move from tearing down the current paradigm to putting up something new. The same is true with what you can call epistemological nihilism or skepticism. There's a lot of this going around. People say, I don't believe anything in the mainstream media, but I'll believe Alex Jones. People will speak earnestly about crisis actors and chemtrails and things like that. Why? Because they believe certain authorities and they don't believe other authorities. This was, I think, really evident during COVID. You know, the establishment spends a lot of time preaching epistemological nihilism to people. But then when it came time to trust the experts, suddenly all that went out the window and we had to trust the experts on things. Well,
suddenly Big Pharma was totally trustworthy and unquestionable and have nothing but positive motives, and they would just want what's best for us.
I remember millennials from high school who were basically all into the punk scene or that type of music, even though it's really bad in hindsight. And they were all fight the system. They're complete bootlickers now. Like they had their masks on. I saw one guy who was like hardcore punk, like praising Ashley Babbitt's killer. These people, they just stand for basically destruction. They never stood for freedom or anything, or even anarchy. They do stand for anarchy, but not like in a deep, like, there's no redeeming factors to like having fun. It's just they're perfect little commissars.
Yeah.
They were always really more, I hate saying communist because they've been replaced by the non-communist left, which is basically gay, rainbow, dysfunctional version of totalitarianism. Like at least communism, like moderate, I don't like communism, but it's at least Yugoslavia wasn't destroying itself. And it was underperforming. It had issues. It also wasn't like genociding their people, wrecking everything. Stuff was bad. It also wasn't, you know, nosediving into oblivion like these people are. But going back to this, one of my favorite books, at least one of the more recent books I like, is The American Regime, which is published by Antelope Hill. And one of my favorite quotes from there, it's not a quote, but a point that is made is about how, you know, the circular epistemology game that the left has, where I think Stephen Colbert joked that, here it is, the now common phrase in response to the conservative complaint of liberal bias in these and other fields made popular by comedian Stephen Colbert, that, quote, reality has a well-known liberal bias, unquote, demonstrate the sentiment of modern liberals who dominate just about every institution in America. And they're basically taking this a priori into it. And it's like the studies say, well, who does the studies? A bunch of liberals, and they're biased. There's also a huge replication crisis where teams cannot replicate the same study. Even in social sciences, if you're being objective, another team of researchers should be able to get the same thing. Even liberal teams of researchers who are simply different researchers can't get the same result. So this is obviously not empirical. This is not objective. And it's just completely made up and nonsensical, and we should not trust them. And they're also probably not, you know, reporting data that goes against them. And law, mm-hmm. which I was, you know, I'm an attorney. One of the things that you have to do if you're a prosecutor, unless you're a DC prosecutor who wants to torture patriots, of course, is hand over exculpatory evidence. There's probably evidence that goes against them that they keep under lock and key. And I think it's very subversive, very dishonest, and it's disgusting. So whenever they bring out their stats, it's the stats they want to see. There could have been twice as many studies going the opposite direction that they are like, this will never see the light of day. This will be erased off of the hard drive, or this will be kept in a vault. So I simply don't trust them.
It's definitely, you know, and you mentioned Stephen Colbert, that him, you know, Michael Moore, it was just astonishing. I'm sure I'll never fully understand how people who made a name for themselves, made a career for themselves, you know, by questioning, being, you know, free speech advocates and having this mega personality about, you know, taking on the power, it just totally reversed course and became nothing but lackeys, bootlickers. Truly astonishing. We could talk about the Zoomers and the differences there and the delicate balance between the ironism and nihilism of the Zoomers and how that can be useful. And also, I agree with you, Dr. Johnson. I interact with Zoomers from time to time, and sometimes the level of irony and nihilism is, quite frankly, off-putting. It's almost like, wow, these guys don't care about anything. Mm-hmm. And it's such a contrast to what many millennials were like, you know, so idealistic, and you know, they want to change the world and they don't want to do normal jobs. They want to do jobs that make a difference, and they don't want mm-hmm. to, you know, shop at regular shops. They want to shop at shops that are making the world a better place and all this stuff. And the Zoomers just don't care in general.
I think we always like look at the two world wars, interwar period. In a way, they basically are like the interwar generation, but instead of a hot war, it's a culture war. Like they are the lost generation after the World War One of 2016. Yeah. Like everything's been smashed, democracy, communism, monarchy, it's all been trashed.
Yes.
And you know, it's bad, but it's also like something that could be forged into something good. Like I think if they were finally given something they could believe in, it could really help a lot.
Well, let's talk then about, let's bring it back to the Homeland Institute. Let's talk about its future plans going forward. So, Greg, you mentioned that really the focus right now is to conduct a lot of polls. So I'll throw it to you. What is the next poll, or what are some of the ideas for polls that the Homeland Institute has in mind?
Okay, well, we have a budget for two more polls right now. And the first poll we're going to do, and we're going to launch this within a week, is on the Great Replacement. The Great Replacement made a lot of news in a couple of polls. A lot of mainstream commentary was generated about these polls because it showed that significant percentages of Republicans, especially, believed that the Great Replacement was a thing, not just a right-wing conspiracy, but a thing that was happening, that was being pushed by the establishment. And of course, the establishment loved these polls because they wanted to use it for more fundraising for the SPLC, more censorship, more deplatforming, more totalitarianism, etc. And we want to ask the same questions. In fact, we're going to ask virtually the same questions as a couple of these polls in the last couple of years that got a lot of traction, just to see if the numbers have changed. And we also have some other more fine-grained questions about people's attitudes connected with the Great Replacement. I want to ask if they are familiar with the white genocide meme, which was coined in 2011, around the same time as Renaud Camus coined the term the Great Replacement. I want to see how far that has penetrated into public consciousness. We want to measure people's attitudes about whether or not white Americans becoming a minority will be good for their children and grandchildren and things like that. We also want to know if these people are aware of the Great Replacement, where they became aware of it. What was the source? Was it Tucker Carlson? Was it the New York Times? Was it far right alternative media? Things like that. So we want to dig a little deeper. We want to use earlier studies as baselines and see if there's been a shift in the numbers. I'm betting there is, and I'm betting it's a shift towards more people believing in it rather than fewer. But we also want to refine our understanding of what people think this is, how they react to different dimensions of it, where they got their news about it, how they form their opinions, and so forth. So that's the basic content of the next poll. We are sharing the questions and the ideas with various thoughtful people in the movement who comment on these polls. We're just asking them, are there questions that you would like to see asked? Are there dimensions of this phenomenon you'd like to see asked about, highlighted in this poll? So once we workshop this a bit, we will launch it probably next week, and it'll take a few weeks for us to get results. We will do this over a couple of week period. I would like to do more than 2,000 people on this, as large a number as possible. We were discussing today whether or not we would limit this to white Americans or Americans of all races. I think because the earlier polls, for instance, the SPLC poll was for Americans of all races, that we to have comparable numbers, we want to do that this time. And it would be very interesting to know, though, if certain non-whites whom we poll believe the Great Replacement is taking place as well. That would be an interesting finding.
I think, too, like the question about how they learned about it is very important, because I'm a former activist. I used to be a chapter mm-hmm. leader in Identity Europa. I know a lot of other activists. All of us have had, along with in real life stuff, they've had their online activism with various SOC accounts over the years. And it does feel at times like you're just screaming into a void. I think it'd be a huge, as they say, white pill or pickup for everybody to see that actually they are making a difference. And it might not be as huge as we think, but it still is something. It's something that cannot be disregarded. People, we are not going to flyer our way to Europa. We're not going to, tweet or I guess X, I'm not sure what the verb of that is, X our way to freedom. But it is important. It is part of the thing. Just like any war, it's not won by the tanks or the infantry or the planes. It's usually combined arms. It's usually everybody working together. And I think this is essential. I think activism is essential. The people who are continuing to do it under this horrible political, this basically what I would call a rainbow terror, with all these dumb Charlottesville cases going after Patriot Front January 6th. The people who continue to do activism, especially in real life, are downright heroic, and I applaud them. I think this would be a huge light pill for them. And two, we can also maybe refine how we do stuff. Like, is internet even bigger than we thought? Is real life activism not screaming into the void? That's big, and I think we need to find this out, and it's going to be very interesting.
Oh, the uses for something like the Homeland Institute are just countless. I think it's very exciting, the potential for this institute, and already we can see that lots of interesting ideas, both in the present and in the future. I had one question before we take questions from the audience. What are the plans of expanding the Homeland Institute over into Europe?
Well, we're focused on America because, we were exploring this issue across the globe, but we're based in America, and America is ground zero for the Great Replacement and these other issues about identity, self-determination, California especially. I think that's why we have so many good California radicals. It does apply to Europe too, the ideas of self-determination, populism, especially in Spain. I know you're a Spaniard, and that's regionalism is very strong there. It's also strong in other...
The Great Replacement. I mean, it's happening here too, at a ever quickening pace.
So we could, if we got more funding, we could explore that more. We could maybe try to explore, like, I have an interest in the Carpathian Basin, like basically Hungary, Romania, the Upper Balkans, just because I have family history from that area. And there's a lot of ethnic diversity, and they've had to deal with that productively over the centuries. And it looks like after several bloody wars, everyone's decided to basically just live and let live finally. But at the end of the day, they're all white. They're all European. They're not going to hate on each other because of a different language or folk dance. They have similar values. But, how does that work? And I have a lot of questions, like I'm interested in the whole intermarium thing, like how could, Central and Eastern Europe stay free of both Russian and American imperialism, mm-hmm. how they can keep the global South from invading. Mm-hmm. They are basically a bulwark against mass invasion coming from the East, along with military invasion, and they're not given enough credit. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of like it's an important question, but the American stuff unfortunately has to come first for now. And a lot of this will be contingent upon how Eastern European politics develop. I'm a huge fan of what Poland is doing in Hungary. I have a lot of high hopes for them. And personally, I do want to learn more about the parliamentary system in Hungary and Poland, because I think, Greg, you have an anecdote where some old lady from Poland said that you go home and tell them that we practice democracy just fine here during one of their huge nationalist rallies. And these are countries where the will of the people actually does work, and where democracy doesn't get instantly subverted by finance like it usually does you know, there's normal gender roles. For whatever reason, people haven't dyed their hair blue. The men aren't weak. You know, what's going on here? Is it, you know, the Faustian culture cycle? Have they just been under communism, therefore are not trustworthy of these weird party politic programs trotted out from NGOs? Are they less urban? And is really, are cities almost as dangerous as a racial question for just destroying populations? These are all questions I have, and I do have I'm going to keep my eye on Poland and Hungary. Hope that answers the question.
Yeah, down the road, if we can find good, trustworthy polling resources for countries in Europe that we can work with, and if we have the money too, of course, I would like to expand, because our primary mission is in the United States, because that's where we're based. However, international comparative studies are very important too, and I'd like to expand. So we're taking baby steps. Like I said earlier, we're starting this on a shoestring. We are greenlighting projects as the money becomes available, and as more money becomes available, we will expand. We will definitely do studies in North America. We'll do Canada as well, eventually, and then we'll go to other Anglosphere countries like Australia, New Zealand, and we will definitely go to the European motherland as well. It really is just a matter of resources and time. And there's just absolutely no limit to what we need to know. This is a Faustian quest, right? There's no end to it. There's no end to troubles. There's no end to folly. And there's no end to the process of setting things right, at least no foreseeable end. And so we have our work cut out for us, but I'm really excited about the whole project. And I think it's going to potentially have important political consequences.
Yeah, this Absolutely. Is the first time that, you know, basically our guys have, you know, this is information warfare. We're in the age of Aquarius or whatever. This is the first time that our guys have had access to this, you know, this power of asking the big questions. It's not about answers. It's about questions. And we get to find out what people actually think. Like, we actually have power now. We have the magic spell. Like, we finally broke this monopoly on information in the culture war. And it's huge. Like, and there's so much to explore, because it's been dominated for decades by subversives, liberals, progressives, cucks, controlled opposition. And it's going to be huge. Like, one of the things I do want to target, it's a target-rich environment, of course, but this whole meme about we're going to get the black vote. This is not anything personal against black people, but it's simply stupid to try to pander to such, it's 13% of the population. And if you look at the numbers, something like only 60, last election, it was like 67% of eligible voters turned up to vote. If you look at total voters, blacks are 11% of the vote for either party. There are only 11% of the electorate. So if half of them were to switch sides, that's like, what, 5%? And that's just simply, it's ridiculous. People are saying that because Trump had a mugshot, that this is going to activate their urban instincts.
We ride with Trump, David.
That's right.
No, we ride with Trump now.
Yeah, man. It's like that video from like 2020 where it's like, I will go to war for Donald Trump because he gave me cash. And that didn't happen. He gave them the platinum plan. It was crude pandering. They took the money, smiled, made some funny Instagram videos, and just, it was a flop. They didn't come vote for Republican, or they didn't show up at all. That's a huge issue. Simply getting people to the polls. It's like, and it's just sad. And it's just, this has never worked before.
I am betting too that the worm tongue political consultants that are whispering in these people's ears and crafting their platforms and talking points never, ever do empirical studies to see if they lose votes by pandering to minorities, if they lose white votes by pandering to minorities. They don't want to know that, right? Maybe the SPLC had some interesting data about what percentage of Black Americans believe in the Great Replacement. They didn't put that in their article about their poll. There are things that the political establishment, they might know, but they don't want the public to know that. They don't want politicians to know it because they want to keep full steam ahead in the course that they have set towards complete destruction of white people, ultimately, and destruction of white society. But we're going to do a study to see if these people are actually losing net numbers of votes by platinum pandering, really grotesque pandering like the platinum plan. It would be interesting to know if Trump actually lost net votes because of that. Some people think that that's plausible, but you know, we had people after the 2020 election, which I believe Trump won, we had people after that election, Wignat type, saying, we are the 5% who stayed home and canceled Trump's victory. 4 years before, these people were saying, we memed Trump into the White House. Well, in neither case could they cite actual data to back that up. What they were just doing is they were just trying to meme facts into existence by sheer assertiveness, thinking that the mainstream media with billions of dollars and control over all these outlets can do it. Why can't we, you know, on the internet do it? Well, the question contains its own answer. But anyway, we are not a force to be reckoned with because there are no numbers that they can reckon with. And they don't want to know the numbers. They don't ask about these numbers, but we're going to ask about these numbers. And it will be very interesting when the day dawns that white identity politics and people like us are not just something that the establishment will evoke as a boogeyman to scare people back to the mainstream. But instead, we are a force to be reckoned with, literally. They can reckon on our numbers and our location and our commitment, and they have to pander to us.
Just another quick question before we send it to the audience. I know we're coming up on the hour here, but I did want to ask then, is Homeland Institute something that can be considered a policy institute? Is all this data, this polling, these questions and the responses and the implications thereof, is the intention that all of that serves the purpose of influencing policymakers? Is that, is that an objective that Homeland Institute has?
Yeah, that's our goal. We want to influence policy in the direction of de-escalating multiculturalism and globalization and diversity worship, because we think that these have gone too far, and yet the entire political establishment really refuses to question these values. They become molochs. They become fake absolutes, fake moral imperatives that you can never have enough of. And that just makes political discourse and democratic governance impossible. And it's driving society towards catastrophe. And it is producing the nemesis that these people have to deal with, which is the rise of national populism. We would like to propose alternatives to pedal to the metal globalization and diversity. And there are many, many projects that we would like to do down the road. One project is, I call it parting ways, and just an exploration of different ways that communities on all levels, from school districts and neighborhoods and towns to regions and states, can go their separate ways, can unscramble the omelet. Secessionist moves, basically. Secessionism on all different levels. We would like to explore this and make resources available to people so that they can consider this as a humane, workable alternative to the destruction of historic communities on homelands. We want to talk about immigration reform. We want to talk about repatriation. All of these are within the broad purview of the Institute, but we'll get there eventually.
Yeah, so one of the things I want to bring up is that it's called home rule. There's different theories about how municipalities and cities relate to the states. And the old-fashioned rule is that cities are simply creatures of the states. They have no rights. The idea of home rule, it's a legal theory, and there's cases in its favor, is that actually no, municipalities have rights inherent to them too. And they can basically butt heads with the states. And there's a lot of legal theory going both ways, yes and for it. But that's something that we need to explore. It's home rule, where it's not just states going their own ways. It's down to the city level or the county level. And that's huge, because then we can empower counties and all that. And if you find a lot of politics is local, everyone's focused on the national level stuff because it's flashy and big. But, you know, we have Section 8 housing invading everywhere. You have out of control civil rights litigation. You know, at some point, a lot of it is local. A lot of the way that the Great Replacement and, you know, bullying from the feds happens is locally. And people need to be equipped with the good law and good strategies to fight back at that local level. It's also easier for one person to engage people because they don't need to do, like, say, a campaign for Senate in California. It's campaign your city, which they will know the political, cultural geography of. They'll know the people. It'll be easier to get volunteers and make an impact. So I'm all about empowering the localities too. And two, I just want to go back to the poll really quickly, is that this is what we made sure that the people polled matched the demographics and the politics of white voters nationwide. This includes all 50 states. It's national. Your mileage will vary. There are probably super red states like West Virginia or somewhere, or little villages in Northern California where these poll numbers will be vastly different. No, the charge of racism was not weaker than the charge of woke, but I'm pretty sure if we got down to the nitty gritty of certain states and certain counties, woke would be stronger overall without even having to break out with only Republicans. So that's very white pilling.
Okay, well, we are coming up. We've passed the hour mark. I know that Dr. Greg Johnson is going to stay on with me for about an hour more. David, are you able to stay with us, or will you be leaving us?
No, I'm happy to stay. I'm having fun. This is great.
Okay. Yeah, great. And before we take questions, I would just like to say, you know, wherever you are listening, just, you know, a quiet round of applause, really, for Greg Johnson and David Zutty here. What they have put together, and everyone else who collaborated in this, is really something just immensely important with immense potential. And I know that particularly online, you know, everyone has their favorite personalities, and you know, decorum is not usually the watchword with online interactions. But I just think that we need to show some appreciation for people who are taking steps to really make something effective and useful and important, like the Homeland Institute. So, you know, putting aside, you know, quabbles over opinions on the Russia-Ukraine conflict or anything else, you know, I just think that what Greg Johnson and David Zutty as well, his contributions to this, I just think it's phenomenal, and I can feel that there's excitement just listening to you both, and the potential for this is, like I said, just immense. And so really, thank you to both of you for putting this together. I can't wait to see all the effects that it's going to have. It's going to be really interesting. I think that this is going to be an arrow in our quiver. It's definitely going to have a lot of utility.
A whole quiver of arrows someday.
Yeah, exactly. A quiver of quivers.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you as well. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. It was a long process putting it together. A lot of people helped. I really appreciate everybody who helped. They're all basically connected to Countercurrents. Our readers, donors, staff, they all did a huge amount to bring this about. And I'm very excited. I'm very proud of Countercurrents. It's been around for more than 13 years. We've published, I don't know, 80 books now. We've published thousands and thousands of articles. And yet I'm starting to think that as this gets off the ground, that this might be the thing that I'm most proud of when I write my memoirs, right, at the end of the career, just getting Homeland going. And I'm really very pleased with David because, again, he's highly qualified. He was in the Air Force. He was in intelligence. You have to be smart to be in intelligence. I'm sorry. The people who say military intelligence is an oxymoron, ha ha, hearty har har. It's not true. You got to be smart in military intelligence. He went to law school. He's really sharp lawyer. He passed the bar in the first try, breezed through it. Yeah, and is very committed. So he did his time in Identity Europa. He got himself doxxed. He's 100% on our team, and he's taking time out of his life and career basically to try and make this his new life and new career. And I'm, you know, very, very grateful to it. It's an act of idealism. It's an act of faith in the ability of the movement to rally around this, the ability of people to come together and make this actually a going proposition and a growing institution. So I'm very proud of what I've done in getting it started. And I'm really, I'm basically putting it in David's hands at this point. So he's going to be the guiding force, the guy who keeps it going. And I'm just looking forward to seeing what he does.
David versus Goliath.
Thanks. I hope to. That's very appropriate. I hope to bring the Air Force value of excellence and all that we do to this program. And I do want to thank, you know, I couldn't say no to this because I've been interested in politics my whole life. People in high school were joking I should run for president because I was so loudly opinionated. And, you know, to actually do this is very fun because, you know, I've done a little bit of normie political stuff. Like I was once upon a time a congressional intern, and to actually do it, this is like a dream come true. I couldn't say no to this. But also there's a little bit of payback here. So yeah, they doxed me and that's backfired. You know what? Sometimes, you know, there's that condescending judge out of Charlottesville, Kaplan, who's like, freedom to act doesn't mean freedom from consequences. Well, that cuts both ways, you idiot. You have basically made me who I am. You have created a monster and a gift to the movement. Like, this is payback. I'm going to have so much fun with it. Yeah, and also, the more doxes start backfiring, the more they're going to back off. Because, like, how many more? I don't want to do this alone. I want more of me. I want more very dedicated, you know, people doing this. And we have a lot of veterans. We have a lot of lawyers. It's very, like, everyone's, you know, making fun of Patriot Front for being feds. No, this is where all the veterans went to, or all the people who would join the military. They're coming to the movement. We have the best men. And I want to be the first starting this new trend of people just taking their docs and turning it into a resume and being proud of it.
Yeah, David also has a poli-sci degree from University of California, San Diego, which is a really very good California school. And he's very knowledgeable about politics, political science. So he's got the background in this, as well as the dedication and the interest and the smarts. And I do think that we need to make doxing backfire. If he hadn't been doxed, he would have gone to work in a law firm and he would have gotten a mortgage and an expensive car and started building his wardrobe out, all the things that young lawyers do.
I would have gone to IKEA just like in a What's Up One movie.
You would have been shopping more upscale than IKEA eventually. yeah. But the thing is that once you get into these career tracks, it's very, very hard, first of all, to find time to do activism because starting lawyers are generally overworked, but they're strung along by promises of big money. It's very prestigious. It's, you know, a lot of lawyers have miserable careers, but there's a great possibility. There's always the promise of prestige and money. And the system co-opts even the best people. And doxing basically closed that possibility off. He was working as a lawyer, but he was not particularly happy with it. And when I started talking about this potentiality, he said, I want to do this. I want to do this instead. And the dox took the sting away from that. It curtailed certain normie possibilities. It could have completely co-opted him and made him into a part-time activist rather than a full-time activist. And that's what we need to do every time somebody's doxed, especially if they lose their job. It would be nice if the movement had the institutional infrastructure to turn part-timers into full-timers. And make the left regret this until maybe they stop doing it. So anyway, this is a happy ending for one dox. And I think that he's going to do great things with this institution.